Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Monday, December 14th. I'm going to be joined shortly by our managing editor, Ed Harrison. But first, with the day's stories, Peter Cooper.
Thanks, Jack. In this time of uncertainty and fear for the U.S., today marks the beginning of a new chapter in the battle against COVID-19. The first of COVID-19 vaccine shots were administered in U.S. hospitals, with critical care nurse Sandra Lindsay at Long Island Jewish Medical Center in Queens, New York, receiving the first one. After the FDA granted emergency use authorization for Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine 3 days ago, the government enacted on plans to distribute the first round of doses, amounting to 2.9 million in the coming weeks. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention recommended that healthcare workers and those in long-term care facilities be the first in line to receive the vaccination. The FDA also plans to review Moderna's vaccine this coming Thursday, which too could be authorized for distribution. Operation Warp Speed has said that 20 million Americans could receive the first shot of the two-course vaccines by year's end. Mexico has also approved the vaccine. The government has already contracted for 34.4 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, and 250,000 are set to arrive later this week. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador announced that the vaccines will be universal, free, and voluntary, hoping that the entire Mexican population will be vaccinated by the end of 2021. Canada has also administered their first doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine today, with five frontline healthcare workers in Ontario being the first Canadians to receive it. The Canadian government has contracts with six other vaccine makers and three additional vaccines under review, including Moderna's vaccine. This all brings joyous news for this holiday season, but the road to recovery will still be long and difficult. Yesterday, globally, 503,718 cases have been reported. 184,248 were from the U.S. alone. And in the U.S., more lockdown restrictions are being enacted. However, the news of the vaccine rollout seems to have support in the markets, with the major U.S. indices up. Upon open, they all experienced a bigger boost and are still slightly up above previous close in intraday trading. Interestingly enough, Pfizer's, BioNTech's, Moderna's, and AstraZeneca's stock prices are all down today, except Alexion Pharmaceuticals. On Saturday, AstraZeneca announced that they would acquire Alexion, whose best-selling drug is Soliris, which is one of the most expensive drugs in the world, and treats a rare and life-threatening disease known as PNH. AstraZeneca is set to acquire Alexion for $39 billion, and the stock prices today moved in opposite directions. AstraZeneca was down 7% on the NASDAQ, and Alexion was up a whopping 30%. Some analysts see this valuation as being too high at $175 a share, when Alexion's closing price on Friday was $121. In other market news, the pound sterling also rallied against the dollar in light of renewed negotiations for a trade deal for Brexit, although no deadline has been set. And the dollar continues to feel downward pressure while treasuries remain in a holding pattern. And with that, back to you, Jack.
Thanks, Peter. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you, Jack.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, good to have you here. What are you thinking about today?
So I am thinking about something that we were discussing earlier in the day, you and I. It's a policy paper that was issued by the G30, it's a group of 30, I guess they're called, on reviving and restructuring the corporate sector post-COVID. And I think that you and I, the reason that we glommed onto this is because of Dion Raboen of Axios. He mentioned that this was something that was coming out. It's chaired by Mario Draghi on the one side and Raghuram Rajan on the other side, both former central bankers really interesting stuff on debt. And I want to talk about that in the context of what's happening in the markets, what we can think about in terms of the economy, and also what's happening with the pandemic right now, those three things, and then into 2021.
Definitely. Ed, if I may, I'm going to just read the first sentence of this report from the Group of 30. The coronavirus pandemic, by dramatically changing consumption patterns and business operations, is triggering a major corporate solvency crisis in many countries. That's quite a dramatic first sentence for this report. So what can you tell me about what this report said in terms of its content and its message?
Well, you know, it's funny you would have read that, because I was thinking about reading the same thing. And I would even go further and read the next two sentences in that first paragraph. And here's what it says. Apart from policies directly supporting employment, initial policy responses to support businesses focused heavily on liquidity issues. Some liquidity support is still needed, but the crucial issue now is solvency. Sorry, I sort of cocked up that reading. But the key is that last part, that the crucial issue now is solvency. And, you know, when I was thinking about this in terms of what we're talking about, I had an epiphany, and that was 8 months after the unfolding. This is something that Rao did. It's a 43-minute video on April the 8th, 2020. Policymakers around the world, the leading policymakers, are now glomming on to his framework. The unfolding framework that he laid out in April is exactly what they're talking about right now. And what they're basically saying is the solvency crisis, you know, the solvency phase of the unfolding that Rao laid out in April is now happening. And they're concerned not just about the second and third wave of the pandemic causing problems, but they're concerned about what happens on the other side, even after we have the vaccine and we go back to a new normal, a post-pandemic new normal.
Right. Ed, just for the folks at home, do you want to explain the differences, the difference between liquidity and solvency, and how they're two sort of different crises, but they're very distinct?
Yeah, so I think what we saw in March, as Rao laid it out, was a liquidity crisis. And that means that I don't have enough money today to deal with the debts that I have that come due tomorrow. It's not that actually I'm bankrupt. It's just that I have a timing issue. It's an intertemporal issue. There's money that I need to have to be able to pay certain debts, and the market is dislocated and I can't get to that money. If the Fed came in or other central banks came in and provided liquidity, then I could live to breathe another day. And then my inherent solvency would see me through ad infinitum. So that's a liquidity crisis. That was phase one that we went through. Then came the hope phase, and you could say to a certain degree we're in that, you know, it's interspersed with the solvency phase. And the hope phase is where, you know, liquidity crisis is over and markets are off to the races. We're at new highs, even though we've had a pandemic and we're actually in the middle of a second and third wave of the pandemic. But, you know, a lot of these companies have staved off the worst of it. But then intermittently and, you know, in stages, Rao laid out that over a very long period of time, not just over a very short period of time, but a lengthened period of time, there's going to be a solvency crisis. And that's, and solvency is where I am actually bankrupt. As a company, I can't make ends meet. A perfect example would be if, let's just say that I'm a cruise line, and it used to be that, you know, my cruise level for revenue was 100 and I had expenses of 90. And now my cruise revenue is 50, but it's only going to get up to 70. Or maybe it's 20 and it's only going to get up to 70 in the foreseeable future. 70 doesn't meet 90. You know, that's a difference of 20. And I can't, you know, get those expenses down enough over time. I'm basically insolvent. And over time, once I learn that really my revenue is down to 70, I haven't figured it out yet. Investors haven't figured it out yet. That's when people will realize I'm actually insolvent, and then I'll have to restructure my debts. So that's the difference between liquidity and solvency. And those are the three phases: the liquidity phase, interspersed by, you know, with the hope phase, and then now going into the solvency phase.
Right. So thank you for breaking that down, the difference between liquidity and solvency. I think of liquidity as you said, a temporary phenomenon, whereas solvency is more lasting. It is the result of business changes. The cruise line is not just that it can't get bonds to market. It can, and it has that money, but the solvency will result as a result of its business model being unsustainable. And that makes me think of this next section in the G30 report, which is about what policymakers should do. And one of the things is that policymakers should adapt to new business realities rather than trying to preserve the status quo. So when I hear the status quo, I'm thinking of movie exhibitors. Perhaps I'm thinking of cruise liners. Airlines, you know, they will survive, but their business model that's based on bulk supply in coach may change as they may expand their offerings in business class and first class. So it's very interesting that this report, the G30, they're talking about somewhat of a new normal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you hit it right on the head. The group of 30, you know, they talked about that. That's bullet number three in a succession of things that they have under the guise of core principles. And they say that, you know, we need to act urgently to tackle the growing corporate solvency crisis. That's number one. And then we need to carefully target public support to optimize the use of resources and help economies to emerge, fitter and stronger. That's number two. But then they get to your point, Jack, number three, that there's a new business reality. And so what it's basically saying is even though we're doing these first two steps to stabilize the ship, actually, we are in a new business reality. And even having done that, bad things are going to happen, not just over the short and medium term, but over the longer term. And we need to understand that there's a fundamental shift that's going to happen. And we need to figure out how we're going to let these companies fail and move towards that new reality without having some sort of crisis in the interim.
Mm. I want to move on to the next point that they say, which is that market forces should generally be allowed to operate, but governments should intervene to address market failures that create substantial social costs. So what they're basically saying here is that governments should act and step up to bolster institutions that are hiring lots of people, that are center points of financial stress, rather than sort of, you know, be a pure free markets oriented approach and let these things fail. Is that a difference of tone, or what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, my takeaway was slightly different. I would say my takeaway is that. We are going through a phase shift. This is a paradigm shift in terms of how our economies operate. That's because of the acceleration of trends that were already in place as a result of the pandemic happening. And so as that shift occurs, there are going to be dislocations. And it's government's role to make those dislocations as little as non-systemic as possible. So to the degree that these dislocations create systemic issues, you know, massive job losses here or liquidity crises there, government should intervene. But we shouldn't, intervene in a massive way to maintain the status quo. You know, for instance, let's say GM or Ford goes bankrupt as they did in 2008. Or actually, it was GM and Chrysler in that case. Ford didn't go bankrupt. What do we do? I don't think that they're saying outright, yes, we should repeat the 2008 scenario where we prop up these companies. Instead, we should make sure that if there are large social costs, that those social costs are dealt with effectively, not necessarily preserve the status quo. So that's the tenor that I get in terms of number three and number four, the two issues that you just raised, Jack, is that they're saying, we do have a transition. We want to make the transition, but we want to make it as smooth as possible. And we can do that through government intervention.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, Ed, your point is well taken. I don't think they are opening up the spigot and being indiscriminate in the industries that they're saving. They're saying that we have to fill in the holes that are left by this pandemic, especially if you look at number 8, be mindful of moral hazard issues without undermining the core objectives. They are striking a balance between, you know, sort of saving economies in the fiscal way and, not inducing moral hazard. But Ed, I want to switch over to a later table in this chart, which is a comparison of the 2020 COVID pandemic to the 2008 financial crisis. And the main thing, the first list is that the initial shock of the 2008 financial crisis was to the balance sheets of banks and households, whereas to the 2020 COVID pandemic, that shocked the balance sheets of businesses and then non-bank high yield lenders. What do you make of this table?
Yeah, so I think what they're saying is that this isn't a systemic crisis in the way that 2008 was, where because it was banks that were at the center of it, we had liquidity and solvency that were inextricably linked. Now, instead, we have liquidity, which was one crisis in the beginning with the banks. But once we were able to, generally speaking, solve that issue, the core solvency problems are divorced from the liquidity issues, and they need to be met. And they're on a different level. Well, here's what I would say. You know, I kind of want to think about it going back to what I was talking about in terms of the three different issues. One is the financial issues today, the markets. Two is the economic issues. And three are the pandemic issues, both over the short and medium term and over the long term. So I think what we're seeing right now, just from a markets perspective, is that a lot of the companies that are going to face solvency issues that we don't know that they're going to face those issues over the longer term, they're the subject of speculative fervor right now, along with, you know, the traditional speculations that we have in companies like Tesla and the large cap tech companies that have done really well. We're seeing this rotation into a whole new swath of companies because we think that we can look through the second and third wave to the post-vaccine era. And so we see this rotation. It was great for the Russell 2000, best month ever in November for smaller companies, best months for cyclical companies, and also very good for pandemic-affected companies. What the Group of 30 is basically telling you is that the optimism associated with what we're having right now is so high that really some of that is going to be given back on the other side. Some of these companies won't even exist. Their stocks are going to go to zero going forward. And so from my perspective, over the short to medium term, we're at a risk of some sort of event that's going to unwind how aggressively we've moved into this rotation, into looking through the second and third wave. Because on the other side of that is not the old normal, it's a new normal. And that new normal is bad for a very large crop of companies that are going to be insolvent.
I see what you're saying about, obviously the distinction of the pandemic is quite clear, but the distinction between the financial reality and the economic reality, I think I understand the distinction is that, a liquidity problem, Norwegian cruises or Carnival cruises, they can issue as many bonds as they want. But if there's a secular lasting change to their business model, which that for the next 2 to 5 years, you know, the thought of going on a cruise is going to leave a bad taste in not just people's minds, but specifically people who used to go on cruises, it won't really matter how much capital you know, cruise liners are able to raise because there's that economic change. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And so, you know, when you think about the S&P 500, I'm looking at a chart of it right now at record highs. The number I'm looking at is above 3,600. Even if you think that the new normal is going to be one where large cap companies come in and they say, okay, you guys went bankrupt in the small cap segment. We're going to take all of your market cap. We're going to take all of your business and everything is going to be hunky-dory. You're only talking about an 80-20 split. The S&P 500 says this index includes 500 leading companies and covers approximately 80% of available market capitalization. So what that basically means is the S&P 500 as a proxy for the economy in terms of what you can get out of it is relatively good in terms of forward-looking GDP growth, falling to the bottom line and becoming earnings growth and therefore, you know, making these companies worth more in the future. So to me, the all-time highs that we're seeing are going to be challenged by the concept that there are still going to be a lot of insolvencies and bankruptcies. I don't know if I got that point across well. What I'm basically trying to say is that even if you see a shift in terms of where the revenue goes within different places just because small businesses are hurt, it doesn't matter. What it really shows is that 80% of the available market capitalization going to S&P 500 companies suggests that we're really seeing a fully priced market at this juncture, and that it's priced for nominal GDP growth that is higher than I think will be the case going forward, and that the Group of 30 is suggesting.
Interesting. Ed, I want to dive a little bit deeper into your thoughts on insolvency. Can you tell me which sectors and which industries do you think are going to be vulnerable to it? You implied it's going to be the companies that are experiencing the value rotation. So that's airlines, cruise liners, energy, banks. But you know, what particularly do you have your eye on there?
I think it's all the companies that we've been talking about, you know, and leisure and travel. We're also talking about REITs that are corporate real estate, things of that nature. The, you know, and then the question becomes, how does that manifest itself at an economy-wide level? What does that mean in terms of the S&P to the degree that the S&P is a proxy for 80% of the value of the economy, since it's 80% of the market capitalization that's available to American companies? What I would say is I would give pushback, for instance, on the interview that we had on Thursday between Kirill Sokoloff and the guy from Morgan Stanley, who was talking about high, this is Michael Wilson talking about nominal GDP growth and inflation. What I would say is that to the degree that you have this this hiccup where you're having a paradigm shift and switching over, in order to have nominal GDP growth that's high, one, that hiccup is going to have to be small. And then two, you're going to have liquidity and fiscal support of the likes that the G30 are talking about in droves in order to drive nominal GDP, both in terms of real GDP and inflation higher, that will fall to the bottom line for the S&P 500 companies. So what I'm saying is absent some sort of increase in your price earnings multiple, really GDP growth, nominal GDP growth, is a proxy for what's available to the S&P 500 companies for earnings growth, unless they have some sort of operating leverage that they can get out, you know, use to boost their earnings. So what that means is that low nominal GDP growth or nominal GDP growth that is less than expected is going to mean lower earnings. And I believe that that's actually what's going to happen. It's not going to be high inflation. It's not going to be real GDP growth. And the reasons are that there's a transition that's going to be difficult. And all we have to supply us is monetary support, that fiscal support, which is what everyone's talking about. That is that debt doesn't matter. It's not going to happen. It's not going to be there. That there is actually much more political risk associated with opening the fiscal taps than people believe. So I think there's a fundamental disconnect with what we're seeing in the markets right now in terms of the ebullient phase and in terms of the reopening and the vaccine and the prospects going forward, both in terms of these bankruptcies and in terms of nominal GDP growth potential for the global economy going forward.
Yeah, there's so much there to unpack. I think the first thing I want to say is I tend to agree with your views that inflation is not going to run as hot as some people say. And my thinking is influenced by Rao's interview with Jeffrey Gundlach, where Mr. Gundlach makes a very nuanced point about the labor market and how it's been made quite clear that there were some job cuts that are or the jobs are may not come back. And I think it's very hard to have inflation with persistent, sustained unemployment. Would you agree with that?
100%. And so then the question becomes, how do you bridge that gap? We bridged it temporarily with fiscal support. You could continue to have that fiscal support on some level, but then you have to ask yourself, how long is that fiscal support going to last? Is the political will there for it to last indefinitely? Well, let's go through a number of different scenarios, a number of different countries. Let's talk about the United States as an example. So we know that we have the Senate, which is 50-48 right now. It could be 50-50 with Kamala Harris being a tiebreak. I believe that in the case that either one of the Georgia senators is Republican, you're not going to have the same level of fiscal support in the United States, which is 13% of the global economy, as would be necessary to have these high nominal GDP growth outcomes. Even if you had a 50-50 tie and Kamala Harris, who is the tiebreaker, number two, I believe that conservatives like Joe Manchin of, I believe he's West Virginia, he would not support opening the taps without some sort of tax offset to that. So again, I think that the space is very limited for that level of fiscal support. So to the degree that you have a longer insolvency phase, to the degree that you have a longer unemployment phase, as you were talking about, Jack, and also this move to the new economy, to the degree that hiccup is longer than expected, you're going to have the need for fiscal support that actually is not going to be coming. This is very reminiscent, by the way, of 2008, where actually, if you look at the numbers, the fiscal support was less than people might have thought because, discretionary spending was lower. Then when you move over to other countries, Europe, do you really think that Germany is going to go from 60% debt to GDP to 100% debt to GDP over, say, a five-year period, six-year period in order to make this happen? It's not going to happen. We already know that the Italians are at 160% debt to GDP. The Greeks are at 180 to 200% debt to GDP. And France, Spain, Portugal are already over 100% debt to GDP. So at the state level, by these currency users, there's no fiscal coming from those countries. Maybe at the EU level, you can load up the debt. I think that there's limited support for EU level debt loading. So those are two big parts of the global economy. Let's call that one quarter to one third of the global economy from a fiscal perspective. Actually, from a fiscal perspective, it's probably even greater. If you have very limited possibilities there on the fiscal side, what it's telling you is that the window for fiscal taps being open is much less than people are talking about. So to the degree that, again, you have insolvencies, you have unemployment, you have a transition into a new normal, you have a problem there because the fiscal support will not be there. And we're already at zero rates and negative rates around the world. I think that the new paradigm is going to be much more difficult than people believe.
Ed, it's very interesting. You actually answered a question that I was going to ask, but you answered it, which was, what do you think about fiscal stimulus? I guess the next thing I want to know is, how does this inform your macroeconomic and your geopolitical view of what 2021 is going to be like? Because I was talking to a friend, and she said, oh my God, I can't wait for 2021. And the implication was that 2021 is, you know, oh God, 2020 is so cursed. And as we approach 2021, it's going to be this whole new thing. It's going to, you know, it's going to, you know, it's going to save us. What's your view? You know, in fact, the dominant, medical opinion, and I don't know what they actually think, but, you know, if you read the papers and the press releases of medical authorities, is that the vaccine will be widely available by the summer. And, you know, maybe people like who are my age, we may not have it, but the people who are, more middle-aged and elderly, they have already been protected. So it's a lot less risky for us to sort of go about, and we'll all go back to normal. How does what you just said inform your view, and how does that your view compare to what I just said?
Yeah, my view is that the second wave is going to be in Europe is going to be really difficult. And the third wave, and it's actually the third wave in the United States, is going to be more difficult. And so the bridge to get to the new normal, which, by the way, I'm saying is a little bit less bullish than people are making it out to be, will be long. And when you compare that to the really bubblicious market sentiment, all market sentiment indicators are showing an incredible level of bullishness in the market. For instance, call option volume is incredibly high relative to where it was, and it's all driven by retail investors as opposed to large investors. I think that Roger Hearst is going to be talking about this on an explainer for the RV Pro platform. Uh-huh. All of that is saying that, you know, retail is really driving things forward because, yes, as you said, market sentiment is really bullish, but that's going to meet a very downbeat situation, both over the medium term and the long term. And I think that sets us up for potential spike in volatility. We saw that sort of volatility in August and in September, and that ended up giving us a bit of a correction. I think that we're setting ourselves up for the exact same sort of thing now at some point in the beginning of 2021. So I think that 2021, at a minimum in the beginning, is going to be a bit of a disappointment. It's going to take the bloom off the rose. I'll give you an example in terms of how I'm thinking about this. Germany, which is a country I thought had done relatively well in terms of dealing with the lockdown, you know, they their case count wasn't so high that they needed to lock down as hard as the French. And so the French locked down hard, the Germans locked down less hard. Now the Germans are running with over 500 deaths a day from COVID. And Angela Merkel on Sunday, just yesterday, said that they're going to go for a hard lockdown in Germany over the Christmas months, which, number one, is terrible for the economy, but number two, tells you where we are in terms of the pandemic before the vaccine is distributed en masse to people like you and me. So bridging that gap, I think, is a lot more than people understand. They think that, you know, it's just around the corner for the vaccine, and when they find out that it's not, and that there's a gap to bridge, I think that's when the volatility will strike.
The volatility will strike. Yes. I think there's sort of two different news flows. There's the news flow of the pandemic is There's a news flow of the vaccine is ready. It's being put in the deep freezers. It's being delivered. The first ones are going to come tomorrow. Oh, wait, they're going to come tomorrow. And I think today they finally were shipped out for real, the Pfizer vaccines, as Peter covered in the intro. And then there's the other narrative of, you know, today was the first day in New York where indoor dining was closed. You know, the mayor put out a press release saying the New York City may go into a full lockdown. Germany is back once again in full lockdown. So I think it's important to pay attention to both of those news flows rather than just one or the other. And you know, they are competing in terms of one is a very positive outlook and the other is very dire. You know, one is looking forward to the future and the other is looking to the extreme chaos and harm that's being we're all experiencing right now. Ed, I feel like we could talk for a lot longer, but I want to close by asking you what the trade is. So you think that a lot of volatility is coming down the pike? Oh, by the way, sorry, just a quick aside. I noticed the S&P and the VIX have risen in tandem over the past 4 or 5 days. That's something to look at. If you look at the like 20-day correlation, it looks back, but you know, that I'd say over the past 5 days, the VIX and the S&P have risen in tandem, and that was a precursor to what we saw in September. But that's just an aside. Ed, I want to ask you what the trade is. So it's, someone watching this would say, okay, it sounds like Ed, he's not a super believer in the rotation stocks, the cruise liners, the banks, the airlines, because of this insolvency crisis that's looming. He also is obviously, and I say your view on this is a lot more fleshed out just because it's so black and white on the, you know, the IPO mania that is going on now. I think I'm being accurate when I say that you don't think that is a good place to park your money. So what is the trade? Is it the FANG stocks?
No, no, I think that the trade is it's relative value. That is looking for places where things are priced the same, but there's actually a difference. One, in terms of forward-looking prospects. Two, in terms of position in the capital structure. And three, in terms of perceived risk to downside in the economy going forward. So, you know, that would be a sector relative value play. That would be a capital structure relative value play. So you're talking equity versus preferred versus senior debt or high yield, you know, which are different parts of the capital structure. And then you're also talking about, you know, leverage on balance sheets, credit, you know. So if you see two credits that have very different outcomes in terms of their leverage and their susceptibility to a downturn in the same sector, but they're trading at relatively tight spreads, then that's also a relative value play. And, you know, I would put it down to this. I think that the Group of 30, when they said their part two, where they said carefully target public support to optimize the use of resources and help economies emerge fitter and stronger, what they're essentially telling us is that the vaccine is coming and we need to bridge the gap to the vaccine, and not just bridge the gap to the vaccine, but once we get to the other side on a continual basis, provide some level of support to deal with the transition to this new normal because of the insolvencies. What I'm saying is that level of support is going to be less than is perceived. So that's where the value, this is where the shock will be to investors when they see that actually, you know, on the other side, even though I also believe that there's a rotation trade to be made, that it's not as great a rotation as they want it to be. So yes, cyclicals should win, and eventually that's the trade that you want, but there are pitfalls within that. And you need to, the trade to make is to look at where the relative value is on the three metrics that I talked about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's as expected, your view is more nuanced than just, I don't like this, I like this. You like balanced sheet strength, and you like companies that aren't dependent on fiscal aid.
Exactly. I like balance sheet strength. I also like companies that are not excessively leveraged to the pandemic. And I also like companies that are not bid up in anticipation of, a rebound, a reopening of the economy, when I think that reopening is not going to be as robust as other people think it's going to be.
Right. Well, Ed, I have a lot more notes of things that I would want to pick your brain on in terms of the U.S. bond market, the European bond market, which is set to tap $2 trillion for the entire year of 2020. But I'll have to save those questions for another time because we're running out of time. But Ed, thank you so much for joining us, or thank you for letting me join you. I've had a great time, as always.
As always, great to talk to you, Jack, and I'll see you again soon.